It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. There are more displaced people on Earth today than there were in the wake of World War II, and many private citizens are stepping forward to help. Later this hour, I'll talk with Ethan and Bethany Anderson of West Liberty about their planned trip to Jordan to work with Syrian refugees. But first, we'll go back in time to another humanitarian crisis and find out about the man who's credited with saving millions of lives. In 1914, World War I began. Military blockades stopped the flow of food and supplies. Millions of people were at risk of starvation, and a private citizen stepped forward to lead an international relief effort. That citizen was Herbert Hoover, who would, of course, go on to become president in 1929. And my guest now is Matthew Schaefer. He's the outreach archivist for the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library, and he'll be speaking about Hoover and food relief during World War I this afternoon at 2 o'clock at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Matt, thanks so much for being here.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
And let's go back in time a little bit before World War I. And for people who don't know the tale, tell me who Herbert Hoover was at that point.
Okay, Hoover's born here in Iowa in 1874, orphaned at age 9, ends up going to Stanford, getting a geology degree, and making a ton of money as a geologist, arguably the richest self-made man in America. His geology career, his mining engineer career, takes him all around the world, and he's in London in August 1914 when war breaks out. He and his family are tending their mining business there. The problem, immediate problem, when war breaks out is credit dries up, shipping comes a cropper, and Hoover says, is asked by the American ambassador to organize an effort to get Americans back stateside.
And the ambassador asked the right man because
absolutely.
Herbert Hoover was a logistical genius.
Indeed. Hoover knew people. He knew how to move goods. I mean, the whole nuts and bolts of mining is getting rocks out of the ground, distilling ore, and then moving the ore to where you can get money for it. So moving people is simpler because they're mobile on their own. But the problem with the war is, you know, funds have dried up. So he has to organize funds. He has to secure safe passage. He has to get tickets to these people. Many of them are literally trapped. You know, they're suitcaseless. They have nothing but the clothes on their back. So they organize little, they get them fed, they get them clothed, they get them back stateside. He and his wife were instrumental in getting over 100,000 people back to the U.S. in the first 6 weeks of the war.
And of course, no good deed goes
unpunished, unrewarded.
Right?
Well, and in this case, that was true as well, because the next element of the war crisis was starvation in Belgium. Belgium had the misfortune of being just to the north of the Maginot Line, the French defenses. And when the Germans invaded in August, they could either hammer through established defenses or do a little workaround and drive through Belgium. Well, driving through Belgium meant that 7 million Belgians were going to be under the heel of the German army behind lines. Belgium, traditionally neutral. The last war they had been involved in was the Napoleonic Wars 100 years before.
So that put all these people at risk of starvation.
Yes, because Belgium was
immediate risk.
The most industrialized country in Europe at the time, imported 80% of its food. And when the German troops came in, they requisitioned all the crops in the field, basically feed the army first. The Belgian citizens had whatever crops they had, whatever wheat and flour they had in storage. But in the cities, there were some cities looking at 10 days worth of food at the end of October.
Now, I think most of us who know our history know that the United States didn't exactly jump in to World War I.
No, America is a neutral nation. America basically adopted Wilson as president said, that's not our war. That's not our conflict. It's not our fight. We have to stand as a moral authority and a force for peace and neutrality. So all Hoover's doing is that as a private citizen for a neutral nation, he's tapped by the American ambassador in London to head the Commission for Relief in Belgium. And Hoover, like you say, no good deed goes unpunished, says, I will take this on, but I have to have some conditions met. I don't want to be in a field of 20 people raising money for food relief in Belgium. I want to be the only food relief effort in Belgium. I want the reins of authority consolidated in my hands. He understood that the fewer with one man at the front, you can get things done. You don't have to work your way through bureaucracy. And Hoover was of a mind that just give me the authority to do this, and I will recruit volunteers, my guys, and we'll make it happen.
Now, that illustrates how very different the world was at that point than it is today. That would be impossible in today's climate.
Absolutely.
What was there a precedent for this kind of action, or was Hoover inventing this?
Hoover was inventing this kind of non-government organization on the fly. And he was the optimal man to do it because he had run this mining company with tens of thousands of employees. He understood the logistics of organizing men and materiel. But he also understood that he was going to have to negotiate with heads of state and on down to secure safe passage for the food. The British had a blockade on Belgium. The German army occupied Belgium. Each of those, the British and the Germans had a vested interest in having somebody else feed the Belgian citizens. Because if the Germans had to feed them, they couldn't feed their army. If the British broke their blockade, then the Germans would have an advantage of not having to feed the Belgians. So Hoover's kind of threading that needle and is able to successfully do that by mobilizing world opinion. One of the first things he did when he was given the charge of heading the CRB was organize a publicity department, a propaganda department, and basically beat the heads of state with the club of world opinion.
So demonstrating that all of these civilians, children, families, were at risk.
Yes, we're at risk of immediate starvation. We need money. We need ships. We need safe passage.
It's hard to imagine the Kaiser in Germany bowing to public opinion in that way.
But he did, and I think the Kaiser realized he had by violating Belgian neutrality had probably pushed as far as he could the bounds of war of what was acceptable in warfare. I mean, back in those days. Those days, there were rules of war. Remember the Geneva Conventions? They actually existed. And neutrals were supposedly not to be involved, not to be engaged, not to be, shot on sight. Well, Germany kind of walked over that line right in 1914.
So Herbert Hoover creates this publicity campaign so that everybody knows what's going on. Mm-hmm. They know what's at stake. And then he also becomes a fundraiser. Who did he turn to? How did he raise funds for this?
Well, his chief fundraising was tapping Belgian assets that were not in Europe. Belgium had an empire, had a lot of offshore assets. Tapped into the British and the French governments, the U.S. government, and then private citizens. Hoover did this thinking that the war in the First World War would be like the last major European war. It would last 6 to 8 weeks. Wars were faster then. And he thought, okay, at the worst, this could stretch into next summer and we could demobilize everything. And if we get to the next harvest, everything will be fine. So he's thinking short and middle term, not thinking this is going to be the next 30 months of his life. And so he's organizing the fundraising, thinking, well, we'll need $100 million to get through these 10 months. And 2 months in, he realizes we've seriously underestimated the need in Belgium. We're going to need $250 million. And it just keeps growing. And ultimately, by the time the CRB winds down in 1919, at the end of the war, $1 billion went through its hands.
And private citizens all over the United States, all over the world, were they donating?
They were donating. There was, like I said, tremendous public outreach effort, efforts to conserve food here. It's UNICEF before UNICEF. Send a dime a day, send a dollar a month, and you can feed a child in Belgium for a week.
Now, I looked at some of the materials you've put together, and one of them was a brochure asking for donations, but talking about how much more money per capita many other nations had contributed to this effort.
Shame plays into it, you know, and America is proud of being, you know, the first to arrive with the most. And yeah, he played that card. He understood. For a man who seemed to have certain psychological blind spots in his own personality, he understood how to work with others and how to push their buttons.
So what did people think of Herbert Hoover at that time? I mean, this is before the U.S. entered the war. Mm-hmm. He is clearly this incredible humanitarian, and you mentioned one of the wealthiest individuals in the United States. What was his reputation?
Well, his reputation, that's an interesting question. I hadn't really thought about it. At the start of the war, he was not known in the United States, aside from a really small circle of mining engineers and his Stanford colleagues. He went to Stanford and had a they tracked him. But if you'd asked somebody in D.C. who Herbert Hoover was, they'd have said, "Who's Hoover?" I mean, that was an ongoing question.
So they were being introduced to this man for the first time.
He's introducing himself by virtue of the good he's doing in Belgium. And when he comes back to the United States in 1917, people know him. He's known to Colonel House. He's known to Woodrow Wilson. They know he's the guy that fed Belgium, saved, you know, cradled starving Belgium in his arms is the metaphor they used.
And 1917, of course, is a major turning point. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a short break, mm-hmm. and we will get back to this conversation in a moment. My guest is Matthew Schaefer. He is the outreach archivist with the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library. He'll be speaking about Hoover and food relief during World War I this afternoon at 2:00 at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. And we are talking about these incredible humanitarian efforts that Herbert Hoover undertook during World War I. And we will continue the conversation in a moment. You're welcome to join with questions or stories. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is Matthew Schaefer. He's the outreach archivist at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library. We're marking presidents today by taking a look back at Herbert Hoover and food relief during World War I. He'll be talking about Hoover and his food relief efforts this afternoon at 2:00 at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. And Matt, just before the break, we got right up to 1917 and, you know, the war started in 1914. That's when Herbert Hoover became involved in this relief organization bringing food to Belgium. 1917, things change again.
Things change.
Because that's when the United States enters the war.
Wilson runs in 1916 on a platform of keeping us out of war. And he fully intended to keep America out of war to be that last necessary broker to broker a peace. Germany realizes early in 1917, we're not going to win this war on the ground. We're going to have to win it at the sea with unrestricted submarine warfare. That changed everything. All the balance that had been, the equilibrium that had been established with the war is now tilted in favor of Germany because they're going to keep food out of Europe by sinking ships as they come across. Hoover sees this and gets his fanny back stateside to meet with Wilson and says, look, this is going to make a huge difference. And Wilson recognizes it, says, well, you know, you go back to do your job with the CRB. I'll take care of things on this end. Wilson declares war April 6th, 1917. Hoover comes back again thinking, okay, the stuff we talked about in February is going to be rolled out right now. I will be the food czar in America. Well, didn't quite play out that way, not immediately at least. America doesn't enter the war fist flying, kind of eases in. It doesn't dive in. It eases into the war. And Hoover's thinking, we don't have time to dilly-dally. We have to get our food stuff lined up. We have to get men in the field. the longer we delay, the worse it's going to be.
Right. He's not concerned just about now civilians starving to death. He's worried that soldiers are going to starve.
Yeah, that soldiers are going to starve, that our allies are going, the soldiers are not going to be fed in the field, that our allies are going to have to sue for peace before we can get American military force on the ground in numbers enough to make a difference.
So he really feels that food is the thing that is going to win the war for the allies.
Hoover was never one early in his career for coining phrases, but here he did. He coined a phrase, food will win the war. Food is as much of a weapon as guns, as bullets, as soldiers, as ships. And it was brilliant because he understood America's first contribution in 1917 was going to be to ramp up food production for export to Europe. And we do. And Hoover does this.
He gets an official role. He is the head of the Food and Drug Administration?
No. America is, we have the Secretary of Agriculture, who's ostensibly in charge of all things agricultural in America. We have the Secretary of Commerce, who's supposed to be in charge of commercial enterprises. Hoover realizes neither of those two entities, neither of those two bureaucracies are going to be big enough, fast enough, mobile enough, nimble enough to deal with this problem. And he says to Wilson, we need to create a war cabinet position called Food Administration, and I'll be your guy. So he's kind of thinking, working outside the existing, and Wilson
again creating
something on the fly. Right. And Wilson is Wilson's history is he is a constitutional scholar, so he's thinking, I'm not sure we have to do. He's wrestling with this, and he wrestles with it for months before he finally, in August 10th, actually Hoover's birthday, 1917, says, "You're my man. We're going to create this Food Administration, and you're the director of this newly created government agency that will exist only for the duration of the war, the U.S. Food Administration."
All right. So Hoover has to find a way to ramp up all of this export from North America to Europe. And he has to ask people for serious sacrifices.
Serious sacrifices. And he's, again, tapping into America's better, the better angels of the nature. He asks them to voluntarily go with Wheatless Wednesdays, meatless Mondays, be more efficient in their use of food, reduce waste, get clean garbage fed to the pigs so the pigs can then be slaughtered and, rendered into fat and bacon and ham and sent off to Europe. And he does this in a very clever way because he understands that in America at this time, food producers are thousands, millions of individual farmers and their wives. So he gets the farmers to rally around by saying, we're going to guarantee you a price point for wheat, a price point for pork, a price point for butter. And he gets the wives to rally around by saying, ignore those guys. You are the one I really need to talk to because you control how food is used in your house. We need to have it used efficiently, reduce waste, clean plates. Here are some recipes for reducing the use of wheat in bread. Here's how to create a meatless meal for Monday. And does this tremendous outreach effort through women's magazines, women's clubs, this is back when women couldn't vote. But he's savvy enough to recognize they
have the power.
They have
kitchen.
The power. They're gonna make decisions that are gonna have a lot more impact on food conservation than the millers, than the farmers, than the distributors.
Now, again, just drawing a parallel between this day and age, if someone in this day and age came and said, you need to sacrifice all of these things so that we can send this food overseas, people would, I'm guessing, respond very poorly to that person. But he managed to have a public relations campaign where people focused their hatred and anger.
Hate the Hun. Can the Kaiser. Let's get it done. Do your part. Every spud a soldier. I mean, he coined the food will win the war, he had some people under him who were brilliant at, sloganing and building posters. And if you come out to the Hoover, you can see some of these posters up. But, every spud a soldier, a little potato with a carbine, a long arm marching off to war.
Now, this was an incredible effort. It went on for a long time, too.
Yes. The U.S. Food Administration was set up to endure the duration of the war. That was its mission. But when war ended, the food needs didn't diminish, because as war ended in Europe, we see revolution. Revolution is taking place in Russia. There's chaos in Austria, in Hungary, in Poland. The war has ravaged Europe. And the normal institutions, like simple things like food distribution centers, railroads, crops, were just in ruins. And Hoover looked in October and November, when war is ending, when it's clear that the Germans are going to sue for peace and the war is going to end, Hoover's already beginning to transition the U.S. Food Administration into a post-war food relief effort.
How did the public respond to that? Because I'm sure having won the war, continuing to make these sacrifices, that has to be a hard sell.
That was difficult. That was difficult. Hoover benefited from the fact that American ag production ramped up during the war. So what Americans were being asked to conserve on went down as time went on. So they were basically able to sell their surplus. I'm not sure it would have worked otherwise, honestly.
Before the war, Hoover is an incredibly successful businessman. Mm-hmm. By the end of the war, he's a public servant.
He's on that slippery slope to public life, and he spends the next, basically the last 50 years of his life as a public servant.
Was that something he wanted?
That's a very good question. And you get different answers depending on what you look at in Hoover's Hoover's letters and notes. There are indications in 1910, 1912, he's written to some friends saying, I've figured out the game of making money and I've won, basically. I want to get into another game. I'd like to get into public service. But, how do you interpret that letter? I want to get into the big game of public service. And his friends said, what does that mean? And Hoover he can't really articulate it. But the big game of public service kind of finds him, and he embraces it. And he runs with it for the last 50 years of his life. I mean, he considers a run for president in 1920. The Democrats are anxious to have him run as a Democrat. A Democrat named Franklin Roosevelt writes to one of Hoover's friends, I think this guy would be a great candidate on our side. And Gibson says to Hoover, dig this. And Hoover says, I'll have to write back, won't I? And he writes back a really gentle letter. I appreciate your offer, but I'm not a member of your tribe.
We're talking about Herbert Hoover's humanitarian efforts before he became president, the food relief that he organized during World War I. With me right now is Matthew Schaefer. He's the outreach archivist at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library. Now, I want to talk about the legacy of this effort. First of all, let's start with the Belgian relief effort, because Herbert Hoover is credited with saving literally millions of lives because of that effort.
Depending on when you count and where you count, 4 million, 9 million, 10 million, and because the numbers change over the course of the war. Any of those numbers is staggering. Any of those numbers is just, you can't wrap your mind around it. And he does it. He creates this CRB out of nothing. Out of voluntary efforts, 170 Americans and thousands of Europeans to distribute the food, and creates a model NGO. And he goes back to that model after the war. When the U.S. Food Administration is winding down and the need for food in Europe is growing because of the Russian Revolution, because of the chaos in Eastern Europe, he creates the American Relief Administration, populates it with people from the CRB who understand the logistics and the difficulty of getting food, from Canada, from Argentina, from the U.S. into Europe, and then across Europe into Eastern Europe, and then transported, often by wagon into food distribution centers.
And the people of Europe also know who they have to thank
they do,
for this
they do.
As well.
I mean,
that's
ironically,
one of my favorite things at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum are the flower bags.
The flower sacks and the gifts of thanks.
And these are the beautiful flower sacks that have been embroidered and then sent as thank yous.
Sent as thank yous to Hoover. And Hoover's not a very sentimental person, but he did have a soft spot in his heart for this. This really meant something to him. The flower sacks, the photos of the school kids and their letters saying thanks. And it doesn't work well on radio. But, yeah, the flower sacks are really, really eye-popping, eye-catching. And it's a way for the citizens of Belgium to say, we understand and we really appreciate your efforts on our behalf. And for Hoover, it's the only thing he kept to document his war years. That he had a room in his house at Stanford after the war called the Belgian Alcove where they had these on display.
This was so
meaningful to him and his wife.
I think it's easy to understand why Franklin Roosevelt might have thought that Herbert Hoover would be sympathetic to Democratic politics.
He worked with a Democratic president. Wilson was a progressive Democrat. Hoover, a progressive Republican. My God, he's doing all this humanitarian aid. By definition, that would make him a Democrat, wouldn't it? No. It made him Herbert Hoover. It's easy to see or to read into the past political ideology of today. And that is, you know, to try to see parallels. And it's a tricky business because the world changes too fast.
Well, and knowing about Herbert Hoover and his personal beliefs and his politics, this was entirely in keeping with what he believed.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
So let's look at the legacy of this kind of a relief effort. He invented it. Mm-hmm. We still have relief efforts like this today, although not just one, of course.
Right. Yeah,
we have many.
Yes. It ironically, the need never seems to diminish. And there's a straight line you can draw between Hoover's food relief people and current food relief efforts like UNICEF. The first head of UNICEF was a guy named Maurice Pate, who basically cut his teeth in food relief with Herbert Hoover and the CRB. And when the United Nations Children's Education Fund was getting underway after World War II, they asked Hoover who would be the best guy to head it. And he said, my man, Mo. You know, and Pate does an awesome job. Pate's nominated for a Nobel Prize. In 64. I don't think he gets it, but...
So the fact that he created this kind of relief, although he worked very closely with the government mm-hmm. at that point, he created a model that is separate from the government and government policies.
Yes. Yeah, he was a firm believer that individual citizens, volunteers, should be the ones in charge because they would have the autonomy and... You know, if they have enough resources, the autonomy and authority to get on the ground and solve the problem without having to think, oh, now, do I have to run this up the chain of command? No, I am the chain of command. I am the top, you know, the top of the pyramid, the top of the decision.
And that means that these agencies can operate even in spite of government policies
well. And that was part of Hoover's genius was that he understood he was one guy. And he knew how far his reach extended, but he also knew to keep pushing it. You know, don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness. And he did the same thing with the people he hired. He just said he hired a guy to basically oversee food distribution in Europe after World War I. And the guy said, well, what do you want me to do? And he said, keep the food moving. And that was it. That was his mission. And as long as he kept the food moving, he was good to go. And okay, I trust you're a professional, you're a problem solver, deal with it.
So this is a remarkable story and obviously a period in Hoover's life that was overshadowed by his presidency and by the stories that have been told about his politics. But in learning about this story, what do you want people to take away from this? What can we learn from these efforts?
That is a profound question and one that give me a second and I'll try to think of something. I think that one person motivated and focused can have an impact. We're not all going to be able to organize the largest food relief effort in history, but you can, when you see wrongs, take actions to right them. And that was kind of Hoover, you know, he didn't set out in 1914 to head the largest food relief effort in history. He just saw a problem and dealt with it, you know, and dealt with it the best he could. That turned out to be pretty, you know, a pretty good answer to a big problem.
He saw hungry people and he wanted to feed them.
Yeah. Can I help? You know, that to me are the three most meaningful words in the English language. Not I love you, can I help?
Matt Schaefer, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Matthew Schaefer is the outreach archivist at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library. He'll be speaking about Hoover and food relief during World War I this afternoon at 2 o'clock at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Coming up in just a moment, I'll be talking with Ethan and Bethany Anderson of West Liberty, Iowa. They've asked that question, how can we help? They'll be traveling to Jordan to work with Syrian refugees. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The world is experiencing a refugee crisis of unprecedented proportions right now. And one of the places where the pain is greatest is Syria. 4.9 million Syrians are refugees. And like so many others, Ethan and Bethany Anderson of West Liberty have watched developments in Syria, wanted to do something beyond donating to non-governmental organizations, and felt helpless to make a difference. Now they've decided that they will travel to Jordan to work with Syrian refugees themselves, and they are here with me now. Hello, Ethan.
Hello.
And hello, Bethany.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you both so much for being here. And you know, a lot of us, of course, have been watching the news and feeling compassion for people who are suffering in parts of the world. What made you feel like you needed to do more than make a donation?
Yeah, I feel like we've been watching this for the last 5 years, and it's just been breaking our hearts for 5 years to see the suffering over there. And, you know, it reminds me specifically of Omran. If you saw that boy, if you look on Facebook for the word Omran, it was a 5-year-old boy who was, you know, caught up in a bombing. And I remember when I saw that, I went home and hugged our 4-year-old boy pretty tight that night, you know. And it's just, boy, I mean, this is the humanitarian crisis of this time, you know. And so we were ready to do more.
And both of you have some experience traveling abroad, living abroad, and working with different mission groups in the past. Bethany, can you give us an idea of some of the things that you've been a part of in the past?
Yeah, sure. And pardon my voice today, but we've both traveled quite a bit. I've spent a year working in Colombia, South America, with Children at Risk, with a mission organization. Ethan has lived for a year in Israel and also traveled quite a bit in the Middle East as well. So we both kind of have traveling in our blood, and this is something that really excites us to kind of get hands-on whenever possible.
Yeah.
How long have you been looking for a way to get actively involved in the relief efforts with Syrian refugees?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think probably like most people, you just feel helpless. I don't know how in the world can we help in a practical way. And obviously there's nothing wrong with sending money. That's a critical thing. But really, actually, it was Bethany who found this church to work with over there. It was just in the last year or so that we thought we're ready to do this.
Yeah, and I think we both kind of looked at each other at some point and said, we need to do something. We need to go or, you know, get hands-on in some way. And so I started doing an internet search, and I found this church in Jordan who is reaching out in really practical ways to these refugees in their town. Their town, Mafraq, Jordan, has been just inundated with refugees there from the Syrian crisis. And so they're really doing an amazing work. And they said they would take us for a few days to help him out. So
tell me about Mafraq. I mean, you've learned quite a lot about this city, and try to put in perspective for us the influx of refugees there.
Right. So it's right there on the border with Jordan, and there's the largest Syrian refugee camp is right outside of the town of Mafraq, al-Zaatari refugee camp, which has approximately 80,000 refugees housed there in the camp. But within the town of Mafraq, which started out with a population of about 60,000 people, it's now doubled in size from the refugees coming in. So it's a huge crisis. There's, you know, shortage of housing, shortage of almost everything. And the refugees who are living in the town don't have access to as many resources as maybe they would in the refugee camp. So that's what the church is trying to fill that gap there.
And as you go to be a part of this effort, you are taking some special skills along with you. You speak Arabic, right, Ethan?
I studied Arabic for a year, yes.
So some basic Arabic.
Some basic Arabic, yes. And that was 14 years ago, so so I'm a little rusty. But, yeah, I've started carrying around my homemade flashcards again in my pocket to try to freshen up. So I'm really excited about stretching that skill a little bit more.
So it's one thing to find an organization, in this case a church, that you feel like is doing something that you want to be a part of, and deciding to actually go there and mm-hmm. and try to help. What tipped the balance there? Why go as opposed to make contributions in other ways?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we're just so excited to be able to help in a practical way. And like Bethany said, traveling being in our blood anyway is it's really exciting for us, I think, to be there on the ground. You can only learn so much from what you can read and watch about it. And so the ability to help physically with our hands and to bring things over there, to bring donations over there, you know, it just, I don't know what tipped the balance exactly, but we just find ourselves being really excited about being involved at that level.
And for me, I think just the ability to go and actually meet Syrian refugees,
right,
and look them in the eye and just show that we care, and there are lots of other people like us who care too. I think that's really important to me, just to be able to show that human connection and that compassion face to face.
What will you be doing when you travel? You're going to be there for what, about 10 days, so
right,
a fairly short trip. But what will you be doing?
So the church has set up a program basically where they, like Bethany was saying, they help the refugees that are trying to resettle in the town. Three main things I guess they do. One is food distribution. Two is kind of what they call a welcome kit, which consists of mattresses, blankets, pillows, a fan, a floor mat, a little cook stove, and a gas canister. So it's kind of something they've figured out. Every family needs this, coming across the border with nothing. So we'll be involved in helping to distribute those to the families. Those are the primary things. And then they also have kind of an informal school where they work on English, Arabic, and mathematics. So I'm not sure how much we could be involved in that part, actually. But physical things, you know, just helping with our hands.
So. You mentioned your four-year-old earlier. You guys have three young kids, so the decision for both mom and dad to go somewhere all the way across the world to a place that's not particularly safe. You're not exactly entering a war zone, but this is certainly not the safest place in the world. Was that a struggle for you to decide that you would both go and do this? Bethany?
It really wasn't for us, because we both feel so strongly about this. And we also have the luxury of having both of our parents close by, and so our kids are going to have a fun vacation at Grandma and Grandpa's while we're gone. And I think it's something that we want to teach our kids, too, from a young age, just that compassion and thinking about other people outside of the world that we see. And we talk to them about refugees and kind of teach them a little bit about what their situation is like, and say that you know, we're going to try to help them. So I think that's an important thing for our kids to learn.
Absolutely. It reminded me yesterday, our five-year-old Lily was saying a prayer for our food, and she said, "And thank you that Daddy and Mommy can go to Jordan and help the refugees." And that's exactly what we want. I mean, we want that our kids to see us doing that. So
once you decided that you would go and had things arranged so you knew it was going to happen, you started sharing this news with people in your lives. How have people responded?
It seems to have really struck a nerve. The church over there sent us a list of practical things that they can use, toiletries, et cetera. And, I mean, we can take, you know, four suitcases. We're already full. people have already just been dropping off things for us. And it just seems like a lot of people want to get involved in some way. So, you know, we are taking donations, too. We said, you know, again, giving money is great, but sometimes you do wonder how much reaches the ground. So in this case, we'll take, you know, whatever people give and, you know, hand it directly to people who are there on the ground who are going to go and buy a mattress or whatever the case may be.
So people have been donating items and donating money for you to take for the effort as well.
Yes.
Yeah. And Ethan has set up a website, too, for people to just learn a little bit more information at ethanandbethany.com. So it comes in handy that Ethan owns a web design agency, so he just whipped up that website for us there. So people can find out more information there about just about the refugee situation as well as how to give if they're interested.
So when exactly do you leave?
Beginning of April, April 5th.
All right. And you'll be there for about 10 days.
Right.
In preparing to go, what are you going to be doing between now and then?
Well, I'm going to be working feverishly on my Arabic. And, just we're gathering supplies, gathering donations as people want to give, and just getting excited, really.
What do you hope to take away from this experience? Because, I mean, clearly you're hoping to make a difference, and obviously this church is doing a great deal, so you'll be sort of the pieces put into that machine, you know, to help for a few days. But it's also pretty clear that this experience is bigger than that for you. What are you hoping to get out of this, Ethan?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, it's easy to think, well, we're just there for a few days and that's what can we possibly do to help the situation? But the bigger part of it is really an awareness, both for us to learn more about the situation and be able to talk about it, and also, you know, for other people to be involved. I feel like what we're doing has given a lot of people an on-ramp to help in ways that otherwise they wouldn't have. And, you know, honestly, we would love to inspire other people to go and do it, too. I feel like we sort of feel like novelties, you know, being people who've raised their hand and said, we'll actually go. We have actually been contacted by people who want to come along, you know, or go. We've talked about maybe bringing a group or something maybe next year, or you know, we feel like there should be a lot of people doing this. So just want to inspire people.
And Bethany, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, just, I mean, going along with what Ethan said, I think that going is so personal and it really helps you to understand the situation so much more deeply than just reading about it. So I think just being able to understand that situation from the inside a little bit more and being able to share that with other people is a big part of it.
Well, and clearly you're already sharing the story and your concerns with others. I mean, when you get back, you'll have these first-person experiences that you'll be able to share with people. What are your plans when you get back to try to spread the word?
Oh, that's a good – let's confer real quick, Bethany. We haven't got that far yet. I don't know.
We have talked about it, and I think we'll, you know, want to look for ways to share our stories. But yeah, Probably on the website at least start there, you know, sharing some stories, but probably look for other ways too.
Yeah, we would – I mean, we'd certainly love to talk about it. I'm sure there'll be places to do that. Yeah, I guess we haven't.
I'm hoping that you'll come back here and talk about your experiences when you get back.
We
you have an invitation
to.
Already. But you're also, you are traveling. You are Americans, and although you don't represent the government of the United States of America, you are participating in a relief effort that clearly isn't popular with the administration right now. Do you have concerns about that? The fact that you know, I'm sure that the United States is not going to be very popular in the eyes of many of the people that you're going to be helping.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely safety concerns, but that we've taken into consideration. And, you know, a lot of people have asked us, is it really safe for you to go? And we're definitely trying to be really smart and really cautious about it. And the church that we're going to be staying with is accustomed to taking foreigners in, and they have their system where they, you know, teach you, you know, you go with locals when you're going out, you know, you don't kind of venture out on your own. And so there are safety precautions in place. And also with Ethan having traveled in the Middle East and speaking Arabic, I feel lots more confident.
And I think the other part about that too is, you know, we don't go into it lightly, but also realizing that, you know, the safest option is not always the right option or the best option. And we feel, not to be too cavalier about it, but we feel as Christians that concept is baked into our religion, you know, that it's a pretty high, it's the second thing, you know, that Christ asked was to love your neighbor as yourself. And so to do that is going to involve some risk, and we just embrace that.
There are a lot of places in the world. I mean, I think Syria is perhaps in the greatest crisis at the moment. But there are a lot of places where people are fleeing, and there are a lot of refugees coming from many other countries as well. Why Syria? Why do you feel like this crisis is the one that moved you to take action?
Yeah, that is a good question, and I feel that deeply. I think it's a personal thing that we've just had an interest in the Middle East. Myself, in particular, I remember sitting on the top of my skateboard ramp when I was like 10 or 11 and trying to learn Arabic, you know, as a as a 10-year-old in Iowa. And I've just always had an interest in that area. So for me personally and for us as a family, it seems like that's become a focus, is the Middle East.
Thank you both so much for coming in today.
Absolutely.
Thank you for having us.
Ethan and Bethany Anderson, they live in West Liberty. You can find out more about them and their trip at ethanandbethany.com. They are going to be traveling to Jordan to work with Syrian refugees in April. Talk of Iowa is produced at Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had production assistance today from Chelsea Hoy. You can get in touch with us anytime. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter at IPR Talk. I'm there too, at Charity Nebbe. And of course, you can like us on Facebook as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.